Hang on, I gotta get my hat out of the freezer.
Did he really put his hat in the freezer?
Probably.
Yeah, things in the things from the freezer are usually cold, though.
I think that, I like that you always think it's the science of something that we don't understand and not, like, the absurdity of it that we are, like, pausing
about. But I'm the one who has a nice, cool hat on his head in this hot room.
You are now listening to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to NPC Cast, your place for face-to-face games. My name is Chris, and I'm coming to you from sunny Seattle, Washington. And like I do every single week, I brought a couple of NPCs along for the ride with me. To my right, hailing from the frozen tundra of the north, he is NPC Del. Del, how are you doing?
Good. Aaron's shaking his head at me like...
Del has gotten to go earlier than me twice now.
Oh, see, it feels real bad, doesn't it?
No, but for real in a row. See how your complaint was that I got to go twice, but I really didn't because I wasn't here a week, so you got to go? You really did go twice because last week, as I was inhaling to start the podcast, you jumped in to make sure you were ahead of me.
Oh, that's the one I wasn't on?
Yeah.
I didn't have anything to do with that episode.
That's not canon.
So I didn't
That's not end canon.
Right.
No, welcome back, Chris.
Thank you, Del. Thank you. I trust that you guys... kept the show in order and didn't do anything out of the ordinary?
No, we make no promises.
Great, excellent. To my left, he is the man, the myth, the legend, the beard. He is NPC Aaron. Aaron, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. So last week, you guys talked about something. What did you talk about last week, Aaron?
We talked about how to start up a new RPG.
And without any sort of comprehension of what that episode entailed, because like I said, I didn't touch the episode at all. You sent me the audio file. I posted it unedited.
I don't believe that is untouched. True at all.
I mean, you did add the music at the beginning, so thank you for that.
No, you don't know because you didn't listen.
I listened to all our podcasts.
No, because otherwise you would be furious that he took out the level up.
The what?
The level up.
That wasn't in there. I listened to it.
Yeah. What happened to our unified front, Del? Yeah. Our unified front.
It's funny. Funny how that goes away when just in a few hours, me and Del, we bonded.
Look, I know where my bread is buttered.
How did that game of craps go that you guys played before I got here?
He has the power of editing.
Yes. Yes, I do. But what I was going to say was last week, you guys talked about how you prepare to start a new RPG. And one of the points that you made, Aaron, and I think it was a very valid point, is that part of that process is understanding that if you are introducing and running a new RPG for your party, you're going to be the one who has to teach that game.
Yes.
And so we figured, let's do an episode about teaching games. Now, these aren't just RPGs that we're going to be teaching. It's going to be board games also. But the idea of... here's what we do when we're teaching a new player a new game.
Yes.
So without further ado, let's get to it, Aaron. What is the number one thing that you want people to know going into this?
You should know that teaching board games is hard, and you learn to be better at it by doing it a whole bunch, especially if you have particularly difficult people that you often have to teach board games to.
I appreciate that you didn't look me directly in the eye while you said that.
Well, I don't know if you could see it if I did, because I'd be looking through the pop filter of the mic.
Yeah.
So I just didn't want to waste the effect. But yeah, if teaching board games is not very easy, especially when you're still new to the hobby. As you play more board games and teach more board games, you kind of figure out what works. It happens to be part of what I do for a job, so I feel like I've gotten pretty good at it. But just because it's hard doesn't mean you shouldn't do it, because... if you are good at teaching board games, it means that you get to play deeper and more complex board games more often.
Yeah, it's actually really funny because this came up in a game designers group that I was recently a part of, and the idea of teaching games. And this past weekend, I was at ETX, which is it was in Tacoma, Washington, and it was a sort of a games convention. It started off as a series of Fantasy Flight tournaments, but kind of grew to a games convention. There was an unpub event there. And I found that I was teaching the game I designed, Nighthawks, over and over and over again. And each time I did it, the process became more streamlined and I got better and better at it. And so I think that that's something that you can sort of take away, is that, like Aaron said, it's a learned skill. And, you know, practicing teaching games, it's going to get easier and easier as you go along. So what are some of the things that we want to keep in mind while we're teaching games, Del?
Make sure everyone holds their questions until the end.
Mm-hmm.
They're gonna jump in. They're gonna say, well, how does that piece work? Well, why does the dog get to move twice? You know, and you just say, well, that's because I picked the dog, and the person teaching it gets to go twice. That's a lie.
Whose phone was that?
That was mine this time.
Oh, so Aaron was actually being unprofessional.
Yeah,
it's very unprofessional.
I mean, it's a very professional sound.
It actually was. I thought it was because Del made a good point. But then I was like, that can't possibly be right.
Do you think literal bells go off in the real world when I make good points?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Happens so rare yet. We don't have enough data to form that conclusion. Okay. So
ask people to hold their questions until the very end, because they're going to want to jump in and know how this piece works with that piece, and they don't know that yet. And you need to make sure that they have the foundations in place before you start teaching interactions.
Right. And I asked Del that question because Del is notorious for asking questions. Usually, though, it's really sort of eerie because he asks a question right before you're about to explain the answer for the question that he's asking.
So in a way, he's a great guide through the process of... or he's close to being a great guide. He's just like a little off
little
in
early.
Calibration.
A little early. What else, Aaron? What's another tidbit that you want to give to people who are getting ready to teach a game?
When you are teaching a game, even if it is not entirely relevant to like the workings of the game, keep attaching things back to the theme to explain like why things work that way. So, you know, if you're teaching Terra Mystica and be like, these are your priests and you're sending them out to work in these elemental cults, because if you're the most dominant civilization in a cult, you get points for that. And like, keep trying to work in little bits of theme to the reason things work, because it will keep people engaged a little better. Most people are pretty, like, the theme of the game matters to them. So, you know, it's always a safe bet to kind of lean into that.
Yeah, and we'll get into like where and how we explain the theme as we're going through the process. But just keep that in mind, that the theme is there to help you. I find that it's easier for me to remember rules, even if the person that's describing it just loosely addresses the theme when they're explaining that rule. So that's a good point. The other thing that you want to make sure of is that you're not being condescending.
And condescending means to talk down to someone, in case you didn't know that.
There you go. That was good. That was actually pretty good. So you don't want to be too condescending, because obviously, you know, you're trying to create an experience for the person you're teaching, and you want them to go into it with, you know, the best possible explanation going forward. And you want them to have a good attitude about it. Because if you're condescending, like, no one wants to be told, you know, that, oh, obviously it works this way because why wouldn't it work this way or whatever. You know, especially if you're dealing with a game that has some familiar elements, like let's say it's a worker placement game, but there's one or two things that are different, people are going to draw some conclusions and maybe even ask questions prematurely that don't necessarily pertain to the game you're playing. But you want to make sure that, hey, like, don't be condescending. Explain to them that you'll get to that question or that it doesn't apply here, and move on. What else, Aaron? What's another big thing that the our listeners should know?
You want to know the game well before you try to teach it. Yeah. If you've only read the rule book and haven't actually like played through it, or at least set the pieces out or moved them around as you read through examples, and really gotten it down pat, it's going to feel really weird when you try to teach it. Like, you're going to feel really put on the spot and anxious. So just make sure that you have the game down really well before you bother teaching it.
Yeah.
And as kind of a flip side of that, you want to make sure that you have everyone's attention. Because if somebody is not really into the idea of learning a game and is on their phone, and you're just going to have to re-explain everything to them later because they don't care, maybe it's time for a lighter game or a game your group already knows. And maybe you learn the game either another time when that person's more focused or when that person's not there.
Yeah, I think in some ways those two tips are can be attached to each other, because if you don't know the game that well, the first thing that you're going to do when you're teaching it is you're going to open the rule book and start reading from the rule book. And that is like the worst way to teach a game.
Or anything.
Right, exactly. No one wants to just hear someone recite basically a textbook at them. So that's like the first way to lose their engagement.
I do want to say there is one caveat, which is if you all went to the store together and had, you know, talked with Aaron, and Aaron said, this game is fun for you to play with your friends, and no one had played it before, I think there is an opportunity to teach while you learn along with everyone.
I mean, if everyone really is into the idea of cracking this game of Spectrops open and jumping in and learning as they go, then fine. But I would say that a much easier way to go through that process is to have one person say, you know what, guys, I'll take the hit. I'm going to read the rules. You guys can play some Akrotiri or some other two-player game in the meantime while I am going to, you know, pour into this. There's an episode of Shut Up and Sit Down that I posted like probably a year or so ago. It's a long time ago, but it was basically an episode about teaching games. And one of like the most brilliant things that I never really even considered when I've been hosting like board game nights or getting or doing board game get-togethers was their first tip, and that's know the game before the players show up. And, you know, they go a step further and have the game set up when the players show up, which is one way to do it. We're going to explain a different way in a second. But I think that that's so powerful. If you can say, you know, hey, guys, I just bought Spectre Ops. How about you guys come over on Wednesday and we'll give it a shot? And then, you know, by the time they show up on Wednesday, you've read the rules, you familiarize yourself with the game so that you can teach it to them and not have to read rules at them. So I think that's a really good point, Aaron.
I have one last really common, seems like common sense thing, but when you're teaching a game, as you mention things that are out on the table, physically gesture to them. Because if you're just explaining and not pointing out what things are, there are going to be a lot of questions at the end where they're like, okay, wait, what's a loyalty tile? What's a...
Yeah, where are the raptors I have to risk? Just hold up the little plastic ship. Say, these are the raptors that go out and explore planets, and you have to roll a 6 or else they explode in space and don't come back.
I thought you were referring to a game called Jurassic Risk, which is a Risk variant using raptors and other dinosaurs.
No, but why aren't we doing that instead of this podcast right now?
What's the continent? Pangaea? So it's like the Risk board is just Pangaea, and you're dinosaurs, and you're going around, and it's basically just Risk with raptors and other dinosaurs. This is brilliant.
Oh yeah.
Raptor Risk.
We're done. Yeah. Somebody write us a check.
Yeah, please. But I do think that's a good point, Aaron. You know, the fact that you want to use as much stimuli as you can, if that means that, you know, you're pointing to tokens, you know, handing them cards to look at while you're explaining, you know, the breakdown of the card and that kind of stuff, I think it really helps. So with that out of the way, those are sort of the basic broad tips that we have. Let's go through the actual process that we take when we teach games, starting with step one?
No, zero. We got step zero.
Oh, see. Because
you got to set up the game. And this is usually where people immediately go wrong with a complicated game. The reason that you want to do something very specific during the setup is you want to enlist the player's help in setting up. So while you're like kind of the chief setup person, you know, you want to, if each player needs to have a certain number of coins, pass the bag of coins around and tell them, go take 5, pass it to the next person. Just keep giving jobs out to the table. It'll help the game get set up faster, and it won't put you through the excruciating experience of setting up a complex Euro while like 4 people stare at you.
Right.
Now, how do you feel about having it set up ahead of time?
If possible, that's awesome. But a lot of times nowadays, you know, I play games at a destination we're all going to, or we play several complicated Euros at once because we're trying to learn them for the podcast, which means it's not possible to set up any but the first without other people there.
So there isn't a philosophical reason to have the players assist in it, like they've been granted additional ownership of the game?
Well, I do think that you are in some ways potentially sacrificing a teaching moment. So if there's a game like Deus where, you know, you're going to have different pieces like in different piles and everyone's going to kind of have their own, you know, pieces to look at, and, you know, the board has to be put together and you're going to be pitching like tokens on the board and stuff. You know, if while you're handing out all those things, you can also be explaining what those things are, that you'll get to them later, I think it can help. Dead of Winter is another one where Dead of Winter is where you have items, and Dead of Winter is kind of a chore to set up at times. So if you can say, all right, I need you to split these items up and put them in these locations. We're going to be going there to, you know, search these decks for food and ammo.
Yeah, at the very least, I think it's good to start using the terminology of the game so people can remember it This is kind of aids with the thing I mentioned about gesturing to things as you point them out. If you're like, hey, can you shuffle this event deck and put it over there? Like, now people know that's an event deck. So there is a philosophical reason to help them, but I do think that it would be equally convenient to start with the game set up, right? Because that's going to just save you a bunch of time.
When you're gauging the option of doing one or the other, I think it depends on the circumstances that you're teaching the game in. If it's a game like Spectre Ops and everyone is super excited to show up and play and you're handing out the cards and explaining, like, you know, the what these are as you're putting them on the board and those types of things, I think it can be helpful. If it's a game that people don't really want to play, like Kaleshka, if you want to teach us Kaleshka, like, it is in your best interest to have it set up when we show up, because we don't want to wait through that. We're already a little bit apprehensive of trying it in the first place, and that's just another barrier that's going to allow us to sort of disengage from the process. So it really depends on the game you're playing and sort of the group that you have, whether or not you can take advantage of the setup or not. So it could go either way. So for some reason, we had a step zero because Aaron made the show notes, but now we actually get to step one, Aaron. The beginning after the beginning.
Yeah, this is where the actual teaching begins.
This is where the action starts.
So the first thing, step one, is to explain the point of the game and any gotchas that the game might have.
Explain a gotcha. What is a gotcha?
So a gotcha rule is any rule that if they find out in the middle of the game, it could sour the experience of the game. Any rules which might cause the game to end prematurely, or rules that would just be like very annoying to have sprung on you mid-game and could ruin an entire player's strategy. Because if there are any of those rules, you know, it's easier to get them out of the way now. Even if you just mention them now up ahead of time and then come back to them again when they're relevant, those are the kind of rules that it doesn't hurt to mention a couple of times, because you want the first playthrough to be fun.
When Alex from Break From Reality was explaining his method of teaching games to us at this designer meetup, he had mentioned this as well, and I thought that it was one of my huge takeaways, because he described it as there's rules in some games that absolutely 100% need to be followed or else the game doesn't work. And those are the rules that you want to make sure that you mention right away. So in Dead of Winter, you might want to show someone a trader card and say, now listen, if someone is a traitor and it says this on their card, then that person is working against the rest of the group. Something like that, so that they know right up front that there's something that they don't want to miss.
Yeah.
It's very important.
As for the basis of the game, what I mean by that is you want to say, what are the players representing? Like, who are they in the game? What are they doing and how they accomplish it? And then how does a player win? What is the victory condition of the game? Do you want me to use my example I made?
Yeah, if you have an example.
So I said, like, using Argent the Consortium as an example, you would say that in Argent the Consortium, you play as staff members at a magical boarding school vying for the headmaster position. To do so, you must enlist your trustee students and magical spells and gain the majority votes from a council of fellow staff members, each with a different hidden criteria for leadership.
So you begin to start incorporating the theme right then and there.
Yes. Again, most people buy in a lot to the theme. The theme really helps get people into a game. It's why publishers often retheme games. If the theme wasn't important, they would never do that. So you want to be leaning on the theme as well. It'll help. Because even if a player is of the very rare type, like our friend Marguerite, who does not care about the theme at all, it's not going to hurt while it's helping her enjoyment, while it's helping everyone else.
Yeah, it's one of those things that it's just a good habit to get into in general. Plus, there are sometimes, even for people who don't really care about a particular theme, there's sometimes where the theme and the mechanic work hand in hand, and it's nice to have that, like, mnemonic device to remember what the mechanic does.
I will give you a perfect example of that.
I'll be the judge of that.
All right. When I was teaching magic to my aunt, who had never played anything more advanced than Pinochle in her whole life, I was able to get her to understand how tapping works, especially tapping lands for mana, by explaining that she was a planeswalker sucking the energy out of this particular area, this forest, this swamp, and you can only suck so much energy up before the this forest is out of energy, and it has to wait a while to regenerate. And that did a whole lot more for her in getting into it than just you turn it sideways, it adds a green. Mm-hmm. You can use the green to buy stuff.
Yeah, no, like, that's a good point. Another example, you know, from Magic, which is, you know, a very complicated game, is something like flying. Even like the name is says enough about the mechanic that it's instantly like, okay, if a creature has flying, only other creatures with flying can block that creature. It makes sense. Okay, cool. Well, Del, let's go to you next. What's step two in this teaching process?
Step two is to explain what a player does on their turn, what options they have available to them. This is going to be, even though this is the shortest in the show notes, this is the longest part of your teaching experience. Mm-hmm. I found that having an additional visual aid goes a long way. I've taught Pandemic a whole bunch, which is not a super complex game, but it is a step above the Risks and Monopolies that people are maybe used to. And by what I've done when I've explained Pandemic before is literally put four quarters in front of a player and said, you can do anything on this card. It costs you 25 cents. And just had them, you know, move stacks over. Uh-huh. And because that whole you can do anything four times or you can do four different things is kind of a weird thing when you're used to just roll dice, move mice.
Yeah, I would say if you're teaching somebody who's really new to board games, that's fine. If you're teaching Pandemic to somebody that's already played a few hobby games and you start pulling out quarters, and it's going to be super condescending when they're like, I get it. I understand an action economy. I have four actions. Like, so be careful that you're not, like, know your audience. Don't insult their intelligence.
Yeah, but that does bring up a good point, though, because I think that where Dell's coming from is, like he said, teaching his aunt, who has only ever played Pinochle and Magic the Gathering. She's super into Legacy.
She actually did run Onslaught Elves.
Well, there you go. So. All right. Well, sure. But it is a different mentality. And that's something that we guess we could have mentioned at the top is that, you know, you're obviously going to want to tailor this process to the individuals that you're teaching.
Yeah, one of the things I'm surprised Aaron didn't mention was asking the person what their familiarity with board games is. I mean, ostensibly you're teaching it to the group you play games with all the time, mm-hmm. in which case that's superfluous. But if you are maybe sitting down with some random people at a friendly local game store to play a game, or you have, you know, you've brought in a game to play and have a little sign up says looking for players, ask them ahead of time, say, what's the most advanced game you've played? You know, how familiar are you with terms like action economy?
Or have you ever played a worker placement game or something like that?
Sure. Although I think if you're doing this method correct, it doesn't matter that much. Because, for instance, the reason I thought of this episode is because I saw a group in our store playing, like, putting together the pieces of a copy of Terra Mystica they had just opened. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's my favorite board game. You guys decided to get like a new game, and they're like, oh, this is our first board game ever. And I was like, oh, well, you jumped right into the deep end. And I was like, would you like some help learning it? And mm-hmm. I taught it the same way I teach every game, and they got it because, like, I mean, I'm going to explain later, but over explaining is better than under explaining. And if you are gesturing to each piece, then even like some terms that they may not know are going to become intuitive because you're good at explaining them.
Mm-hmm. So you find that in your method, the way that you teach games, you don't teach a novice gamer any different than an advanced gamer.
Not really. I mean, if I'm teaching games to like us and Marguerite, I might go a little different than if I'm teaching somebody a gateway game that's their first game. But, I mean, that's going to be inherent because there's so much less to explain in the gateway game, right, as is. But in general, the methodology here should carry to any – should work for pretty much anyone. Right. I mean, don't – but, you know, also, again, don't be a jerk. Don't be condescending. Gamers like to feel smart, and if you start, like, talking down to them and explaining terms that you know, like, might seem obvious with quarters – or with, you know, like they could feel like you're making fun of them.
I have a question for Aaron. How do you feel about letting players discover engines and other things on their own? For instance, not explaining to the Pandemic player where when there's five options on their card and they have four quarters, that they could just clear disease four times in a row. rather than do four of the five things?
I would always say that I would explain very explicitly that you can do four different options once or one option four times in any combination between them, because that in some games you can't. Like in some games you have four or five actions, you get two actions, and they have to be different. Takenoko, unless you have the right weather on the die, you cannot take the same action twice. So I would say it's pretty important to explicitly state whether or not you can take that. I bet if you don't explain it, like, odds are good that that question will be asked.
What I'm asking is, does letting the player go, but can I do the same thing four times? Then you get to go yes, and saying yes makes people feel good and smart, like they are on top of things.
If they ask, then answer, but don't not tell them and hope they ask, because that's the worst. But what I think the spirit of your question is correct. When you're explaining, you don't need to tell them like what the good options for playing the game are all the time, because that's they just need to know to play, and they should discover what choices are good and bad on their own. That's right. The stuff that's fun as a gamer. So if we're playing Terra Mystica, I am not going to say, like, oh, you're playing this race, you should really rush your stronghold, because then I'm just playing the game for them. I'm just telling them what to do. I tell them all the things that are available to them and then let them choose in general. When we get later, there is kind of some exceptions to that. But I wanted to quickly jump on a gotcha that comes up here oftentimes.
And here as in when you're explaining what a player does on a given turn?
Yeah. If there are different units of time in the game, like if there are turns, rounds, phases, and all that, and they're used and they mean different things, this is a good place to really define them and explain what they are. Because you'll find that you have a lot of bad habits where you use those terms interchangeably when you're explaining things. And so when games use multiples of them, you want to be real careful in explicitly using the correct one. I use Terra Mystica as an example for this step because it has turn like actions, and then those actions we go in turn, and that makes up a round of the game when we're all done with actions. So, people could get confused about what a turn is and what a round is and what an action is there. So you have to be careful.
When you're teaching someone what they can do in a turn, do you go in the order of the turn, or do you ever mix that up? And the reason I bring it up is because something that Alex did when he was teaching us Euphoria is he almost reverse engineered the systems of the game to the point where he was like, you want to accomplish, you're trying to accomplish or, get influence. And the way you get influence is by, getting support and building buildings. And the way you build buildings is by getting these resources. And the way you get these resources is by going to these areas and collecting these resources. And sort of like walked you backwards through the process. So you saw how, you saw what the end goal was and then kind of breadcrumbed your way back. Is that a technique that you use, or do you go more linear?
I think it depends on the structure of the game.
Yeah.
In a game like Euphoria, where there is kind of a get A to do B, get B to do C, I think it's important. That's why I would say whatever the ultimate goal is, explain that in step one. Mm-hmm. Like, your goal is to get influence. Like, that's, you'll person with most influence wins the game or whatever. As where, like, in Terra Mystica, there are eight actions, and there's no definitive order you should be doing them in. It depends on where everyone is placed on the board, what races are out there are going to govern that. So it's harder to like do it in that game, but you can explain each of the eight actions. When you're explaining these actions in a very complicated game, you're inevitably going to hit actions that have like entire mini games or subsystems to them.
Yeah.
At this point, I don't explain them fully. I note that there is a subsystem there, and that I will explain that entire subsystem in its next step. So, for instance, when I'm explaining Terra Mystica, I explain the concept of the power actions and taking them and spending power, and then I say, I'm going to explain power all at once, because it's kind of like its own part of the game and has a lot to it. So I denote it, and then I move on, I finish explaining the basis of the game, and then I'll come back to that in step three.
Right. Is there anything else in this section that you want to make sure that we highlight?
Sure. As you go through each of the options the players have, walk one player through that action. So say like, okay, so you have a trading or a dwelling on the board, Tom. If you wanted to upgrade that to a counting house, you would take the dwelling off, put the counting house on, pay this much, which is listed right here, and now you'd have the counting house, and it gives these benefits. And you want to do that with each option? And you want to use a different player for each one, because what that can help is if you are teaching a game that you might have to walk away from afterwards or can't be there, there's a communal understanding of the game. Like, you've drilled one concept very well into Tom's head, even if the other players don't get it, and he can step in your place once you walk away from that table and go, oh, no, well, remember that I remember that when you do this, this is what happens. So I always make sure to use an example of a player at the table and to rotate and use all the players for different things.
Yeah, and that's another thing that I picked up from Alex. It's like the class. It's a classic teaching trick that teachers use.
Classic Alex.
Classic. That's what we call him. Classic Alex. But it's the idea that if someone asks a clarifying question about something you've already explained, he'll turn to another player at the table and be like, "Does anyone else know like the answer to Del's question? Anyone?"
Yeah. Aaron? Each one teach one. It's one of the central tenets of the Black Panthers.
Yeah, I think that's where he got it from. I think that's exactly where he got it from. Classic Alex. Oh, man. But I think that that's another way to sort of it reinforce the idea that they can sort of teach each other and make sure that they're understanding as they go. Cool. So what is the next step, Aaron, in teaching a game to somebody?
This is kind of like the fill-in-the-blank step. So step three is explain subsystems, make sure terminology and concepts are understood.
All right.
So complicated games are going to have those subsystems I mentioned that are kind of games unto themselves, although even simple games often have them, like the farmer scoring and Carcassonne is one that you really have to kind of explain. In fact, a lot of people don't even use farmers in their first game of Carcassonne for that reason.
They're so awesome.
So you're going to have to explain this. So I then, in this step, I'm going to go through those subsystems first, and I'm going to explain each of them thoroughly. In Terra Mystica, I'm going to explain power, I'm going to explain cities, and I'm going to explain adjacency and that whole concept, because those things are all related to the actions, but are their own kind of parts of the game. If I was teaching, like, let's say, Battlestar Galactica, that game is a mesh of subsystems. So there, you know, depending on which angle you took it from, now might be the time to explain how space combat works.
Or throwing Aaron in the brig.
Yeah. Or the brig, or any specific things like that. So first I fill in all those subsystems.
So I want to ask a clarifying question here, and I'll use Carcassonne as an example, because I think that it's a good example for the question I'm about to ask. See how I did that? Anyways, in Carcassonne, you can explain the process of you're going to draw a tile, you're going to place a tile, then you have the option to take one of your meeples and place it on the tile that you have just put onto the board in these locations. You can place it on the road, you can place it on the in the farm, in the field, you can place it on a cloister, place it in a city, whatever. Do you explain, like when you say you can place it on a road and it becomes a bandit, and then explain how bandits score? Or is scoring in Carcassonne an example of a subsystem that you save till later?
I have often explained how each one scores, because people, just through experience, people grok all of them except the farmer pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, the two main ones, roads and castles, are the more tiles of this thing, the more points you get. So
right.
those are pretty simple. But I traditionally will be like, you can also place farmers in a field, and I'll get to that at the end because it's a little weirder, mainly because I'm laying tiles out to explain. And to really grasp the concept of farmers, you need a lot more tiles there just to kind of show how it works.
Sure.
And so, yeah, I could see the argument for just treating scoring as its own subsystem, but I think that it's simple enough and tied enough to the actions of placing the guy that you could probably just explain it as part of the action.
Yeah, I think in my history of teaching Carcassonne, I save it because it's something that, like, you're conscious of it during play, but it doesn't come to the end. So, like, in the narrative of a Carcassonne game, since you're not, you know, typically scoring until stuff is completed, you know, after you've placed them, I will, like, save that to the end. But I could see it going either way, though. So, yeah, it's Carcassonne is a very, you know, simple simple system. And, you know, like you said, they're tied together so closely that you could go either way with it. But I was just curious about that. So this is Dell's favorite part. So I want to make sure that he gets to talk about the next step.
Yes.
And what is that?
Shouldn't I ask, what is it?
Dell, come on.
It's questions.
Yes, it is questions. And what do we mean by questions, Dell? What's important about asking questions and having questions asked?
The reason that you don't say, oh, by the way, this is something I learned from a Harvard long distance course I took.
Okay.
Never, ever, ever say, does anyone have any questions?
All right. Ever. Why not?
Because social stigma and the spiral of silence will cause people to say, no, I think I got it. Always ask, what are your questions?
Oh, okay.
It's a very subtle thing, but language is very powerful. And by asking, what are your questions, you now have put them on the spot where if they don't ask a question, they will feel like an idiot.
And it is our goal to make them feel like an idiot.
No. If you ask it the first way, you say, what are your questions? Yep. Then they feel like an idiot by saying, oh, I have a question. I don't get it. You know, and
or does anyone have any questions? I have a question. I feel like an idiot.
Right. Whereas you say, what are your questions? Now each person is compelled to ask something to look smart in front of their peers.
Yeah. Or they feel silly for having a question and not asking it because...
Right.
You're saying, what are your questions? Like the assumption is that people are going to have questions, and therefore it's okay to ask a question. That's a really good tip. What else about questions, though, Aaron, is important?
Understand that people are going to ask questions for things you already explained.
Yeah.
You're going to have to explain them again, and don't complain about it and just deal with it. It's part of teaching games.
Like, I don't understand how the orcs move.
Yeah, even if you already explained that twice, somebody's going to ask, and that's okay. And you don't want to single them out or even say that you already explained it, because that's just going to make them feel dumb, and then they're not going to want to learn games at the table again. And then the other important thing is that if you did your job correctly, players are going to answer each other's questions. Like somebody's
Yeah,
gonna
Chris,
ask.
The orcs move two up and one over. What are you, stupid?
And if they answer like that, scold them. But no, they're going to answer each other's questions because, you know, like I said, you're going to give examples to each player. That player will often answer a question if it dealt with what they did.
Yeah.
And when they do that, let them finish answering and then only correct them if there was something incorrect or something not explained.
Right. And that was that classic Alex method of... you know, allowing the players to sort of, you know, he would even, you know, defer to a player, says, does anyone remember how the orcs move? Or Aaron, do you remember how the orcs move? And you'd be like, yes, they move this way. Cool. Yep, that's right. So there you go. After the questions phase, people have like asked their questions. They seem like they got it going. What's next, Aaron?
Some people skip this step, but I think it's very important. And that is to do a sample round turn phase or whatever chunk of the game best, like, make sure everyone understands and can play the game. It's going to depend on the game on what that is. If you're teaching Ticket to Ride, you probably don't have to like go that long. You know, you can probably
two turns.
Yeah, a couple turns. Let one person play some trains and show that that's the correct way to do it. And the moment that happens, we're like, okay. And you don't have to restart the game, but offer the restart of the game. Say, okay, we've played like a sample turn. Should we restart the game now that everyone understands it?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times people will go like, nah, I think we're okay, and they'll keep playing. But sometimes people will go like, oh, okay, now I get it. Let's play for real.
Yeah. If the game is like, if it's a quick enough reset, I'll sometimes even go into it with the expectation. I'll say, all right, let's play for a few sample turns, and if we got it, we'll do a game for real. So I think it just depends on, you know, what the game is and, you know, how complex or whatever the turns are. Something that I got from my old days when I used to work at Games Workshop, when it was my job to teach things to people, it wasn't always teaching games, but it was often teaching like hobbying techniques or those kind of things, painting techniques. And they used, you know, one of the time-tested business methods of the coaching model, is what they called it. And the coaching model was like a four-step repeatable process, and it's explain, show, observe, correct, praise, repeat. Basically.
Correct/praise.
Yes, correct/praise.
Okay, don't correct their praise because they probably haven't given any.
Yeah, yeah. So it's correct/praise, and then you know you go back through that. You repeat that process until they have it down, you know. And that's kind of what we're talking about is, you know, you've explained it to them, you've shown them by, you know, taking them through like a sample turn and showing them, you know, the how it works. You observe them playing, and there's a very good chance that they get it, you know, spot on. And then you either say, oh, no, you're there to catch them if they're messing up and correct their actions. And then once they got it, you're like, cool, you guys got it. You can either start over or keep playing. And there you go.
I have something that is not on Aaron's list.
Okay.
That I would like to add.
Sure.
And Aaron's going to disagree with me, but uh-oh. Aaron's wrong and I'm right. Tank your first game that you play with other people.
No, don't do that.
Not necessarily literally throw the game, but when your little cousin walks in and sees you playing Smash Brothers and says, "I looks fun, can I play?" You don't go right to Captain Falcon and then wombo combo him off the board. Okay?
I mean, life's hard. Get used to it, Alex.
Why is that? He's also Alex?
Yeah,
he's a lot of Alexes these days.
No, there's two parts to this. One is, and this is something that has kept me from playing competitive first-person shooters online, is that there is a skill cliff that if I am being 360 no-scope from across the map before I can get out of the spawn, I don't even get to explore the map and learn the layout of where the weapons are, and I die too fast and I get frustrated. It's not fun to play against someone who has an incredibly disparate skill level from you. It's not. And in the same way, if someone maybe doesn't take Houston to New Orleans immediately in Ticket to Ride because they know that that will stop anyone from being able to complete their Miami to LA routes. If someone doesn't take that right away, like, that's correct. You do always want to block that and Nashville to Atlanta. But if you don't do that and you give the other players at least a chance to win or keep it close, it makes them more excited to play again. Winning your first game feels really good, and it gives you a good afterglow of that game. And your eventual goal is to get to play a lot more games with that person of this game.
I think it is completely dependent on the circumstance, on the person you're playing with, the game being taught, and maybe most importantly, the intent of the teaching process. And I'll give you a great example. Malifaux. I have demoed a lot of Malifaux for people, and I have introduced a lot of new players to the game of Malifaux. We mentioned on our System Mastery episode, Malifaux is a game that is super deep, and because of that, it's very, very complex. Okay.
Do you always go hard in the paint immediately against new players?
I'm starting to agree. All right. I'm trying to agree with you.
We talked about this like he'll ask the thing you're about to explain.
I'm trying to agree with you right now.
I'm a precog. I can't help it.
Well, you're wrong. Anyways, so Malifaux is a very, very deep, deep game with a ton of different stuff, right? So when I'm going into it and my goal is to teach the person across the table from me how to play the game of Malifaux, I will purposely not use all of the abilities that my models have because it becomes confusing and overwhelming for that player. So no, I don't go hard in the paint, so to speak, to that player. I'm not necessarily tanking the game. I mean, you could look at it that way if I'm not using every resource available to me to win the game. But more important to me during that process is making sure that they understand what their models do and how to play the game. Not that, you know, you don't want to bunch your models up against Sonya, or that a flame wall can totally wreck your day if you're not looking out for it. That's not what I'm trying to teach them at this point. The flip side of that, though, and this is me, I guess, waffling like I'm prone to do, or at least I've heard I do on last week's episode. But the other half of that is if I'm sitting down with you guys and, yeah, like I read the rules for this game. I've learned it. We're going into our first game or whatever. Like, I'm not going to tank that game just because I'm the one who learned the rules. Like, I'm going to play because we're getting together to play. That's like, there's a difference in playing to play the game and teaching the game in order to play it versus teaching the game in order to teach the game, if that makes sense. I think that if I'm teaching my cousin Magic, I'm going to go easy on him because I'm trying to get him to learn the game of Magic so I can play with him in perpetuity. If I'm teaching you guys how to play Istanbul, like, we're going to play, and we might only play it a couple times ever anyway. So I'm going to teach you the game, and we're going to play it for reals. So,
yeah, I think that you never throw the game, but the things I leave out of the games aren't, when I'm teaching to teach is not necessarily that I go easy. I do what you said. I leave things out so the game is understandable. Because right. most adults can like understand, I'm learning this game. I'm going to lose, probably. Like, the other person has played it more than me, clearly. I'm going to lose. And it's also different if it's a five-player game or a two-player heads-up game.
Right.
You know, losing feels very differently in those types of games. So, I don't crush someone. And, you know, if I was teaching if I'm teaching somebody a fighting game, I don't just obliterate them and give them no chance. But these games aren't Twitch games for the most part. So, there's no skill like cliff. There's a skill curve. There's definitely, you get better as you play more.
Yeah.
But it's very different from that online experience. I would say don't be a jerk. If you do beat somebody that you're teaching the game to, don't like trash talk them if that's going to hurt their feelings, because yes, you already knew the game well. That was the first thing we said, know the game well. So, yeah. Odds were good that you would win. But don't, like, also, you know what's really bad is knowing that somebody is tanking the game and letting you win.
Right.
That's even more deflating than getting beaten at a game, and is kind of frustrating because you're thinking, it's kind of condescending. It's like, oh, they don't think I can understand this game well enough to compete, so they're doing dumb things, like, just to keep me in it. It's even worse. So, no, yeah. I don't think tank is a good rule. I think knowing what you're doing and playing the game accordingly to keep it fun is a good rule, but you know, it's up to you how you want to teach a game. I say you know, don't be a jerk.
Yeah, like you know, to Dell's point, I guess and to sort of bring my long diatribe down to a very like concise point, is that if I'm teaching someone how to play Magic the Gathering, I'm not going to play a combo deck where I combo off in the first turn. Because every time I do that, they're not learning anything.
That's what I said about shooters.
About shooting games.
Yeah. About first person shooters. That's the exact point I made.
In this podcast?
Like 5 minutes ago.
Did he talk about first person shooters? I thought he was talking about Smash Brothers.
He mentioned getting 360 no scoped before you leave the spawn.
Oh, so, that's yeah, a shooter
it obviously
thing?
Holds true. It's not a perfect analogy. Like, it falls apart in a lot of games. It works in Magic because
right.
there are combo decks that wreck the game.
Look, if you can't beat Dredge, you got no business playing my game.
Now you're yes. making your opposite point.
Yes. But I think that's the thing, though, is that, like, is if winning the game as quickly and as efficiently as possible is going to prevent them from actually learning what you're teaching them, like, then you're not actually teaching them the
yeah.
game.
I think the easier way to say that is you don't necessarily have to tank, but don't be a gatekeeper to enjoying the game.
Yeah. And just keep in mind, like, what the goal of the process is. If your goal is to teach a player who you know, your cousin comes over and he's like, hey, I want to learn how to play, you know, this game, make sure that you teach them that game first and foremost. And even if you can teach them the game and beat them at it, then by all means do that. But if beating them at it and not, you know, pulling any punches is prevents them from actually learning the game that you're teaching them, then there's where the issue comes up. So, all right, well, that's good stuff.
We have one more step.
What's the last step?
Play the game for real. For realsies.
That's not like a step in teaching the game.
Yeah, that is. Step six. It's the most important step of all.
You put a step zero and a superfluous step six. This should have been a six-step course.
Man, he's calling you out.
You wasted the sixth step. You a blank sixth step, and you added a zero step. I'm just saying, like, efficiency-wise. You have a blank sixth step.
If you leave out step six, people might not know to actually play the game now.
We're gonna have
just stopped after an example turn, and then they're just doing nothing. They're just staring at each other going, all right. Gosh, I wish there was a step that told us what to do from here.
Well, step seven is to let us know what you think about this episode. Let us know if these tips have been helpful to you. Let us know your horror stories about Dell just thrashing you at Magic with, you know, I'm sure there's
ad nauseum.
A few of you out there that have experienced that.
He just plays like draw, go, control, and just never lets them cast a spell.
Counterspell.
That's even more miserable than turn one combo.
Yeah, because they're forced to play the game. all right, so yeah, you can reach out to us on social media. My Twitter handle is @NPCChris. Aaron?
At NPC Aaron.
Del.
At NPC DEL.
If you want to tweet at the whole gang, you can do that. It is at NPCcast on Twitter. We have a Facebook page as well. And what is that Facebook URL, Del?
It is facebook.com/NPCcast.
It sure is. And we have an email address. And what is that email address, Aaron?
It is thenpccast@gmail.com.
We got something else, Del, don't we?
Yes.
What is that?
We have a Patreon page.
We do.
That you can send us money for us to make even more awesome content.
Yeah, if you want to support us financially, you don't have to. The content's still free. But if you want to support us financially, you can do that by going to patreon.com/NPCcast. And we have reached our $50 goal, mm-hmm. thanks to the producer of last show, Derek. And that means that me and Del are going to do a live stream of Jurassic Dread.
I think Aaron's in on it too.
Hopefully,
maybe.
Aaron's on in on it too, as long as the scheduling works out.
Yeah, otherwise, we'll
see.
Otherwise, we'll get some friend PCs in.
Yeah. So we owe you guys a stream of Jurassic Dread. We're going to work on the scheduling for that. It'll be in the next few weeks, I'm sure. So that'll be good times. But before we go, we're going to tell you the things we're excited about, and we're going to do that right now. All right, Del. What are you excited about?
I'm excited about a new TV series that is out, and season one is already done because it was a Netflix series, so the whole thing came out, and you could binge on it over just a weekend.
I love that.
It's the best.
Love that.
It's great until you're done with the show.
Yeah.
Because, like, you watch the whole show in, like, 3 days, so there's even more days between when you get to watch the next season.
It's like when you buy a carton of ice cream and you eat it all in one sitting, and you don't have any more ice cream.
Yeah.
The only problem I have is that Netflix will occasionally go, "Are you okay? You've been watching for X hours." I'm like, obviously I'm not okay. I've been sitting here watching Netflix for 3 hours.
Legally they're required to do that, or else there's too much liability there on their behalf. So tell us about the show you're excited about, Del.
I'm excited about a new show called Sense8.
I don't know this one.
Sense8, which is a word but is stylized as the word sense and then the number 8. Sense8 is basically the best realization we've gotten of a Philip K. Dick story, except for Blade Runner and Total Recall.
Okay.
But I mean, the best TV series that we were ever going to get out of Philip K. Dick, who is this incredibly prescient sci-fi author of the 70s and 80s.
All right.
And it's about 8 people around the world who share a mind and share emotions and thoughts. And what's great about it is the pedigree of its creators. So in addition to being based on a Philip K. Dick story, its showrunner and producer is J. Michael Straczynski, who did the unbelievably good Rising Stars comic series, and also did a little show called Babylon 5 you might have heard of.
I've heard of that one.
Yeah. He also wrote the Doctor Doom crying issue of Spider-Man.
Okay.
After 9/11. But we're not going to hold that against him. And the other producers are Lana and Andy Wachowski, who did a show called The Matrix.
Oh, the Wachowskis. Wachowskis.
Yes.
Yeah. Very cool.
So between the Wachowskis, J. Michael Straczynski, Philip K. Dick, and the fact that a lot of it was shot on location in the Ukraine.
I thought you were going to say in the future.
But. No. In the Ukraine, in South Korea, in, you know, all these exotic locales, and they're on location rather than just, you know, it's Vancouver and we put a StarCraft stadium in the background, so it's South Korea now. So it's really well done, and I like it a lot. Aaron?
Are you asking for my opinion on Sense8 or for what I am excited about?
No.
I've watched the first 2 episodes of Sense8. I thought it was really good. I haven't got around to watching again because I've been busy, but I think it's a cool concept. I'm a Philip K. Dick fan, even though I've never read this particular story. I'm eager to finish up the season and then wait a whole year for another season. The problem is that this happened, and then, like, I forgot anything else that was going to be on TV because True Detective Season 2 started to get advertised, and I was like, yes, I am on board for that.
Yeah, see, I don't watch that much Netflix, unfortunately. I have found that I cannot work very well when I have things on in the background that I want to pay attention to, obviously. So I'm like halfway through The Quest, and I'm trying to finish that, but I'll put this in the queue, though. Once The Quest is over, then I'll move on to some
Sense8.
Some Sense8. Yeah.
God, I love the Quest.
It is hilarious. It is really good. I am excited about a new website, new service, new, I don't know what you call it, browser app. I don't, whatever you want to call it, I'm excited about it. It is called Paperize, and it's available at paperize.io.
Is that with an S or a Z?
A Z. I should say it will be available at paperize.io. They are currently taking signups to be notified when the beta is ready. So as our listeners know, we design games, and you know, when you design games, you need to make prototypes, and making prototypes, especially of card games, in the past has been tedious. Now, if you're familiar with, you know, the program InDesign, you have access to that program, there are ways to sort of automate it, but not everyone has access to it. It's professional grade software, and not everyone can use that. Paperize is a way to make card game prototypes very quickly and automated. And what do I mean by automated? I mean that you can design your card game in a spreadsheet, like you can do with Google Docs or wherever you want. Take that spreadsheet file, that CSV file, upload it into Paperize, and Paperize will automate all of the cards created for you. So you can say, you know, look at the Paperize template and say, here's where I want my name column to go. Here's where I want this, you know,
cost
column to go. Here's where I want this text column to go. And Paperize will spit out a print-ready prototype version of your game. You can incorporate art. You can say, for this card, I want art, and you can go to, you know, Google image search, because again, these are prototypes. You're not selling these or anything like that. You can find some Creative Commons images, and you can plug them into your cards. Super easy, super fast. There's a few different templates they have. They're working on a way to make it so that templates are modifiable. But it's a really, really great service for people who are interested in making card game prototypes quickly and easily. One of the things I'm really, really passionate about right now is the idea of rapid prototyping. I, you know, took some advice from Chevy Dodd, who is a game designer of some note within the indie game design world. And the idea that as soon as I have an idea, I want to take it out of my head, put it onto cards, and start moving it around and playing it and seeing how it works. Because then I can start to address, you know, the issues that come up and find out very quickly whether or not the game's going to work.
That's actually how Steve Jobs philosophized things.
Yeah.
His whole policy was iterate, iterate, iterate.
Yeah, and that's really what game design and development is. So you want to start that process earlier and earlier. I've heard game designers describe it as you want to start making mistakes as quickly as you possibly can to start making the best game possible. So paperize.io, like I said, it's in its sort of beta stages right now. I do have a key to it, but I hadn't, by the time we recorded this episode, I had not had a chance to actually check it out yet. Although I'm going to email them and see, I might actually do that, do a session of Paperize for my first non-Jurassic Dread live stream. I might get on Paperize on live stream and show you guys how it works and kind of check it out, because I think it's a really, really cool tool, and I'm all about tools that help the layman design neat things. So there you go. Aaron, I know that you've seen the page, you've seen the video.
Yeah, I'm jealous because you managed to finagle access to it, and I don't have it yet.
I just dropped the NPC cast name. I was like, hey,
I gotta do that too. I gotta be like, hey, I want to also shill for you.
Yeah,
please let me in.
let me shill.
So yeah, I'm super jealous. I'm still using Magic Set Editor for my card game prototypes, but it has this tendency to distract some people. But they're like, this looks very much like a Magic card. And I'd be like, yes, I'm using Magic Set Editor, blah, 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 blah. So I kind of wish there was a more generic like template I could use, which would sounds like Paperize would work great.
Yeah, so like I said, they have three templates right now, I think, that are available. They're going to add more. One of them is a fantasy template, which is very much like a Magic card. However, it doesn't have the Magic card textures or the fake Magic card textures, so it's not quite as close to a Magic the Gathering clone. But again, the big game changer for me, and this actually happened for me with InDesign, because I actually happen to be lucky enough to have the creative suite because of this podcast and because of the work I do for Card Kingdom. I have InDesign available to me, and there was a Daniel Solis blog and video series about using this data merge feature, which is basically allows you to take stuff from a spreadsheet and put it on, and it totally changed the way that I prototype. And now that technology, that feature is available or is going to be available for anyone, which is really, really cool. I love it. What about you, Aaron? What are you excited about?
So I was going to be excited about an Istanbul expansion until I started to register for events for Go Play Northwest, which is it's going on basically once this podcast comes out. It'll be like hours till it starts. Which I know that you guys had to opt out of, but I'm still going. So if there's any listeners there, I'm talking to you right now. but I signed up for a couple events ahead of time, and the one that I was most excited about is a game I didn't know existed. It is called Sirai Civil War. That's S-I-R-A-I. And it is a game by Jason Morningstar.
I mean,
basically, this is a 22-player like mix of a story game, a light war game, and diplomacy. Each of you has a character drawn from one of six factions. Although there are a few, like, it sounds like there's some wild card characters that aren't necessarily part of a faction. You have access to a certain number of resources and unit cards that you can use, and you are vying for control of a map that is laid out across the floor of the room you're in.
Like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Similar, because you're going to walk around and talk to people, and when the phase of, like, the kind of free play phase ends, wherever you're standing, that's where your character is, as, like,
in America,
move around and whatnot. No, Del, on
you
the map.
You said Civil War.
It's a Civil War, not like the Civil War.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's actually like a sci-fi setting. But your character is part of one of these factions, but you don't even necessarily fully get, like, some of you will have strife within your faction, like, and it's asymmetrical. It's not balanced. Not everyone is equally as powerful in this world. Some of you gotta scheme and get together to topple more powerful people. But, like, so instance, like, Chris could have a reason to hate me right from the start, even though we're in the same faction. His little, like, character could say, like, I slept with his wife or something, and we have a problem right off the bat. So while we both want our faction to succeed, if he can get me killed in the crossfire during the game, like, more power to him. And it sounds so awesome. I've read my player orientation packet. I'm super excited. 22 players. It sounds awesome.
I am now jelly.
I am pretty jelly right now.
So yeah, I'm excited to kind of test this. I don't know if it's like coming out in a more like released form or if it's the kind of thing that's like
it seems too like weird. It would be difficult.
Yeah, to, like,
it seems
release,
very
like,
conspecific.
I'm kickstarting this game that really only works at, when you have 20 plus people
in this room.
Yeah. I don't know exactly how it will work out beyond that, but I am very excited to play this game. It's already the highlight of my weekend in my mind. So,
are you going to live tweet this game? Is that allowed?
I don't know. I feel like I want to be in the moment. So it depends. Like, if maybe I'll live tweet it in character.
Yeah, do that.
My character tweets. I don't know. But I'm very excited. I'm generally just excited to go to a story game convention because all of the stuff that we complain about players like not doing, I feel like this is the one place that like players will do. Like, everyone who wants to play this game downloaded a 15-page packet, and I'm pretty sure we all are actually reading it,
right?
Because it's all like it's all NPCs basically playing this game. So I'm super excited to play some really like weird stuff.
So do you have your character then?
No, those are given out at the game because they don't want any sort of collusion ahead of time. Yeah,
it's good. That sounds exciting. I'm jealous. What day is that?
Midday Saturday.
Okay.
So I think it's like 4 to 8, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
after lunchtime.
So make sure to check the Twitters midday Saturday. Check Aaron's Twitters and see if he's tweeting as Zardoc, adulterer or whatever. Cool. Very awesome. Well, that's the show. If you have been listening on iTunes, we appreciate it very much. You can, of course, subscribe on iTunes. That helps us out. And you can also give us a review on iTunes. If you give us a 5-star review, Del will read it on the air in the voice of your choice. If you're listening on Stitcher Radio, we also appreciate you. Press a plus, thumbs up, star, whatever it takes to get us onto your favorites list that helps us out in the Stitcher algorithms. Of course, there is one thing that we actively ask all of our listeners to do. And what is that, Aaron?
Tell a friend.
Yeah, teach a friend to like our show.
Tell them during your giant 22-player...
Yeah.
As I eliminate people, as I send my mobs out to do suicide bombing runs and blow up the buildings they're in, I plan to soften the blow by handing them an NPC cast card.
Yeah, they don't feel successful loser then.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah, tell a friend. Please. Please tell friends about our show. You can do it via social media by sharing our stuff on Facebook or Twitter. You can do it face-to-face while you're at a Story Games convention with NPC Aaron. We appreciate it. Word of mouth is the best form of advertisement, and we would not be where we are right now without your guys' help. Truly, truly appreciate it. On that note, you can add 1,000 XP to your character sheets, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye. NPC Cast is written by Chris, Dell, and Aaron. You can reach us on Twitter at twitter.com/NPCcast or by email at thenpccast@gmail.com. As always, support your local game store.
This podcast is a part of the Signals Media All-Star Network. For more information on this and other fine shows, go to signalsmedia.com. It's okay to stick our stuff in your ears. Really?